Let me pray. Father, thank you so much for just the opportunity to come together with a new class, a new topic to focus on. And I pray, Lord, that you would allow us to be teachable, to hear what we need to hear, to remember, internalize what's from you. And Lord, I pray that what I'm sharing is certainly faithful to your word. But Lord, just in all of it, we acknowledge that apart from you, we really can't do anything. I can't teach apart from you, or we can't receive and be teachable apart from you. So we pray that you would bless us and make this time profitable for our hearts, for our walks with you. And we ask it all in Jesus' name. Amen. Okay, so welcome to Toxic Emotions. My name's Ryan McCarthy. If you haven't been in the class with me, I'm the Soul Care Associate Pastor. So this topic, toxic emotions, what I had in mind was when I say toxic emotions is not a formal term. I made it up. I mean, I think I made it up. I probably heard it somewhere. But I have things in mind, probably like you do, things like despair, paralyzing anxiety, agonizing shame, you know, revulsion. I've got them listed on a little chart here of some of the things that come to my mind, fury and rage. But as I go through that list of things, I'm just listing normal emotions turned up in volume. I mean, like, intensified. And I'm sadness, fear, guilt, anger, everything I just listed, it can find its roots in just a normal emotion that we all experience. And so before we talk about toxic emotions, I think we need to be clear what normal emotions are. I mean, this is all very much related, and how to deal with them. Well, how do you deal with the toxic emotion? It's very similar to how you deal with any regular emotion. And also, I'm going to look at today, why did God give us emotions? What's its purpose? And everything that we talk about today will be at the foundation of where we go for the next 5 weeks. And my hope is just biblical clarity on this topic. It gives us an appreciation for the fact that God made us emotional. So we're going to start by understanding emotions. And I have a definition on your notes. It's not a technical definition, but they are physical sensations. Emotions are physical sensations in response to thoughts and beliefs about particular events and relationships. I kind of mapped it out this way. Emotions are what we experience physically. They're a response, a reaction, a natural, nobody has to teach us to be emotional, just a natural reaction to things that we are thinking or believing, but in response to circumstances, relationships. And so it is the bloom, it's the fruit, it's a symptom of other things that are going on. So we're not dealing with just emotions in a vacuum. Emotions are always tied. My throat's been bugging me for like all morning, so hopefully I don't distract you with this, but it's distracting me. They are outworkings of stuff that we often don't consider when we're thinking about emotions. The emotion itself is what makes the news for us. Feeling anger, feeling anxiety, but there's all these other things, there's layers. So I was thinking about this also, the difference between emotions and moods. Emotions are tied to particular things. Moods are more of like a general setting that we might experience. You're dismissed. That's it. Okay? So, but to understand more, let's understand God's purpose in giving us emotions. Wow. I'm feeling really awkward right now. Just letting you know that. Yeah, it's my mood. Yes, it's actually my thoughts and beliefs tied to fear of teaching. Okay, so emotions have a God-given purpose. And this is your first blank. Emotions are, God gave them to us because they move us to action. This is self-explanatory. Some verses that just kind of show this. Exodus 32, when Moses goes up, he receives the Ten Commandments. During that, receiving the Ten Commandments, Aaron and the Israelites, they kind of go astray. They build a golden calf. They throw a party. all sorts of debauchery happens. And when Moses comes down, he's angry. Moses burns with anger. His anger burned hot, and it moved him to throw down the Ten Commandments. All right, his anger moved him. I'm not sure if that was a productive response. I'm sure God willed it, but Moses' anger moved him to throw down the Ten Commandments. Another emotion, King David, when he lost his son Absalom, the king was deeply moved and went up to the chamber over the gate and wept. Okay, his grief moved him to get away and just weep. Simple. Jesus was moved with pity when a man with a withered hand came and said, "Are you willing to heal me, to make me clean?" And he was moved. His compassion, he felt for this guy, and he was compelled by pity or compassion, which are the same word. It moved him to heal this guy. But some everyday examples. If you're stressed by demands at work, then the emotion of anxiety, you know, will move you to get to the office early. Simple. If your spouse throws you under the bus, I almost said under the boat. It's more the nerves. If your spouse throws you under the bus, your anger will move you to defend yourself. If you love fine art, passion will move you to go to the museum. If you're attracted to someone, right, that will move you to desire, will move you to go to talk to that person. Fear at the same time will move you to freak out and not know what to say. All right, all these different, that's why in the animal cruelty commercials, they have Sarah McLachlan sing and "I Will Remember You." They didn't just tell you about animal cruelty. They have Sarah McLachlan tapping into the emotion of like compassion with a song and showing the pictures, because they know people will not respond to just the information, right? So they're tapping into an emotion. So emotions move us to action. Next, emotions inject color into life. They provide the greatest pleasures of life. You know, joy, love, delight, acceptance, belonging, peace. But also, they're tied to our greatest struggles and agonies in life. So sadness, embarrassment, anger. I can't multitask, but I'm pulling up something on my phone here because I want to give you an example. If you take away this aspect, just emotions injecting color into life, life would be very gray, very bland. There wouldn't be anything to look forward to or anything. So when I look at a passage like this, Paul is clearly emotional when he says it. Now to him who's able to do immeasurably more than all we ask or imagine. He's emotional in this. I put this into my phone, and I am asking Siri to read this for us because Siri doesn't have a whole lot of emotion. So here's Siri giving an emotional passage. If it works.
Now to him who is able to do immeasurably more than all we ask or imagine, according to his power that is at work within us. 21, to him be glory in the church and in Christ Jesus throughout all generations, forever and ever. Amen. Ephesians 3:20-21.
Okay. Is that inspiring? No. When you read a passage like that, we're supposed to be tapped into an emotion feeling with Paul. And sometimes when we don't have emotion, everything's gray, everything's flat. Okay, so emotions inject color into life. Another thing, emotions connect us relationally. This is so far, I mean, there's nothing brand new. This might not be brand new to us, but this is where I start feeling like, oh, I need this. Emotions connect us relationally. The first verse that comes to mind for this is Romans 12:15. Rejoice with those who rejoice, weep with those who weep. So in the middle of Paul telling us what the Christian life is supposed to look like, Romans 1-11 is everything that God's done for us in Christ. And then he says in chapter 12, verse 1, therefore I urge you, brothers, in view of God's mercy, to live your lives, you know, as a spiritual sacrifice before God. Our lives are supposed to be oriented around God. And then from chapter 12 on, he starts unpacking what the Christian life is supposed to look like. Right there in the middle of all that, he says, Rejoice with those who rejoice. Weep with those who weep. When someone is experiencing deep sadness and you don't feel sad with them, you're not connecting, right? So if someone's really excited, when you hear a girl on the phone and she's saying, "He what? Really?" You know that the person on the other line is excited about something, right? She's joining. They're connecting over the phone, over an emotion. And if this person says, "Guess what? Chad talked to me." "He what?" Okay, they're connecting. But if she says, "Guess what? Chad talked to me." Okay. You're saying, I'm not going to join you where you're at. I'm just going to receive that. And then what we often do is, someone's sad. I had a horrible day. I'm really hurting here. And well, you ought to just do this. You know, we naturally want to fix somebody and say, well, hey, instead of, I got really stressed out. Well, you should get there 15 minutes earlier and do this or that. And at that moment, instead of connecting with them emotionally, we fix them and it creates a sense of divide, right? And we're natural fixers, especially us husbands and fathers. I mean, I do that kind of, that's my natural default setting. It's a lesson I'm trying to slowly learn. That's why I think this verse is another way of saying it. It's a little richer of a way to state the same idea. Whoever sings songs to a heavy heart is like one who takes a garment on a cold day and like vinegar on soda. So someone's sad and they're hurting, and you're just, "Oh, it's great, it's fine, don't worry." I'm not going to sing a song right now, but if you sing to that person and be all cheerful, it stings. It hurts. It's like taking a garment on a cold day. And I had to look up what pouring vinegar on soda meant. What's that? It boils it? Yeah, it causes almost a violent reaction, and it ruins both. It ruins the soda and the vinegar. And so to try to fix someone is saying, "I'm not with you. I'm not going to leave my emotional state to join you in yours." How many of you have seen the movie Inside Out? It's an interesting cartoon. It's about Riley is a 12-year-old girl, I think, and they moved to San Francisco, her family, her mom and dad and Riley. And the whole time they have, you could see inside their brains, and they have five different characters representing love, joy, fear, sadness, and disgust. I think are the five emotions that are represented. And you see the interchange. It's really interesting. So this clip that I'm about to show, joy and sadness have been pushed away from Riley. It's inside Riley's head, and you're following Joy, who's yellow, and sadness is blue, and they're trying to find their ways back into Riley's heart. Because so Riley is kind of going through a depression in having moved to San Francisco. I mean, need I say more? Take that, San Francisco. But the whole time, they're trying to find their way back into Riley's head, I guess, and they come across Bing Bong. And Bing Bong is Riley's childhood imaginary friend. And you'll be able to tell who it is. So what's happening is Bing Bong is being forgotten totally. Like, and all the things they did together are being pushed into the memory dump. This is all sounds very weird if you haven't seen the movie. But so Bing Bong is being forgotten, and he's starting to grieve over that. So I want you to watch the attempts that Joy makes to comfort Bing Bong, and then look what sadness does to comfort.
The stuffed animal hall of fame! My rocket! Wait, Riley and I were still using that rocket. It still has some song power left. Who is your friend who likes to play? No, you can't take my rocket to the dump. Riley and I are going to the moon. Riley can't be done with me.
Hey, it's gonna be okay. We can fix this. We just need to get back to headquarters. Which way to the train station?
I had a whole trip planned for us.
Hey, who's ticklish, huh? Here comes the tickle monster. Hey, Bing Bong, look at this. Oh, here's a fun game. You point to the train station and we all go there. Won't that be fun? Come on, let's go to the train station.
I'm sorry they took your rocket. They took something that you loved. It's gone. Forever.
Sadness. Don't make him feel worse.
Sorry.
It's all I had left of Riley.
I bet you and Riley had great adventures.
Oh, they were wonderful. Once we flew back in time, we had breakfast twice that day.
Sadness!
It sounds amazing. I bet Riley liked it.
Oh, she did. We were best friends.
Yeah, it's sad.
I'm okay now. Come on, the train station is this way.
How did you do that?
I don't know. He was sad, so I listened to what...
Hey! There's the train!
Pretty good illustration of that, huh? Oh, yeah, yeah, give him a round of applause. Yeah, I mean, but that's exactly, it's interesting because what she started to say in response to that, I mean, how'd you get Bing Bong to respond? Well, I've just listened to what he said, and she felt sad with him. Sadness came naturally to sadness, right? But sadness doesn't always come naturally to us because what's behind joining someone in their emotion? It's motivated by caring about them. If they're sad, I mean, parents have that phrase, you're only as happy as your saddest child or something. How's that go? Yeah, that's the idea. That's the idea. And I mean, because your parents, you don't really have to teach, I mean, most of them, you don't have to teach them how to feel compassion for their kids. It's going to naturally happen that you feel with them and you're excited with them. Not all the time. There's exceptions. But when we're preoccupied with the way we feel or with what's going on and someone else feels something that's different, I mean, if you're down and someone you really care about just receives great news, that care for them will bring you up with them as well. But this idea is very key to everything we're going to be talking about is emotions were given by God to connect us relationally. And I added this verse, 1 Corinthians 12:26. It says, if one member suffers, one member of the church suffers, all members of the church, that's the context, all suffer together. If one is honored, all rejoice together. And the point here is if the body of Christ, we're a family, the closer the relationship, the stronger this truth comes through. We should feel the strongest for the people who are closest to us. And then as it goes out from there, we have, you know, it should kind of break down a little bit or water down from distance, if that makes sense. Brandy, who's here, my wife, she's very good at this. More naturally compassionate. She has, if our kids are upset, I'm able to tune it out a lot, you know, but if one of them is upset, it's like fingernails on a chalkboard for Brandy. And she just feels with them. She feels for me. She's more compassionate. So that's my disclaimer, because I'm going to give one example where this is early on in our marriage. This is early on. I think I've shared this before. This is not typical. But when I was at my previous job, I was the Life Stage 1 pastor. And I was really called to a place where I had to lead, just lead. And I was leading a bunch of high capacity guys. And they all had different opinions about what needed to be done. They all spent their money and did their goals differently. And I'm supposed to keep these guys together. It wasn't my strong suit, okay? So I came home a lot of days exhausted and sometimes feeling like, man, I'm just killing this thing slowly. That's how I felt at times. And I remember this just happening once at least, where I came home and I was like, Brandy said, how's your day? And I was like, yeah, it was okay. Michael wants this, and you know, Jeff wants that, and I kind of didn't know what to say for these guys, and I know Bill wants me to do this, and Brandy would say, well, why don't you do this and that, etc. And it would be a really good idea, but what was, and it was probably an idea I went with, but did I feel better? Now, I wasn't worried about necessarily what to do. I was worried about, is my lack of leadership killing this slowly? And here, I went to seminary. I'm the professional pastor here. And now I share something with my wife, and she's got a better idea than I do. Oh, I must be really bad at this. That's okay. And so it was a totally well-meaning, and it was actually, I remember it was good advice. But it was what I was needing at that moment was comfort, or you know, just to say, oh, that stinks. Now, I've never gotten it wrong the other way. I always get it right. When Brandy shares her heart with me, I'm right there with her. My one example of Brandy is that's the exception to the rule. But that's something that we can gain a lot of mileage just from remembering, okay, emotions are given to us by God to connect us relationally. And we'll be talking more about that, but that's key to where we're going. Okay. There's a book I read. I listened to it called How to Talk to Your Children So They'll Listen and How to Listen So They'll Talk. And the premise that stuck out is exactly this, is that when kids are down or they're hurting or they're crying over something, usually we fix them. We tell them, well, hey, suck it up or do this. And the whole premise of the book is to say, join them in their feeling first, you know. Oh, that happened. Oh, that sounds painful. I'm so sorry. Then not why are you crying? Or this is what you should do. And they gave this an analogy. They said, imagine you wake up and you have a headache and you have to go to work, but you have this really bad headache. And on your way to work, your friend calls and, hey, what's up? Man, I got a headache. I don't want to go to work. And if your friend says, well, you need to suck it up and go to work, forget you. Like, friends don't talk to us that way. They're like, oh, I know, that stinks. You know, so I know. So you go ahead and you hang up the phone and you go to work. But your friends usually join you in your emotion. But in parenting, we tend to forget that. And so I try to implement that with my kids. It's hard to know when I'm not spoiling them if I overdo it. I usually do one extreme or the other. But I better move on because at this rate, we'll get out at 3:00. Okay, emotions are an essential way we bear God's image. They're an essential way we bear God's image. I'm thinking of Genesis 1:27 here. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. So God created us, and the word image is we are a reflection or a representation. Those are the two words for what image means. Image is a statue is an image of, it represents someone as an image, but also a mirror is an image that reflects. We are reflections and representations of God. So the same way the moon reflects the light of the sun, we are like the moon. The sun is the source of light. We reflect the light of God. We are images of God. God is emotional. He experiences joy, anger, sadness, jealousy. He created us, and we too experience emotions just like God does. God interacts with his creation dynamically. He's not cold and robotic, sitting at a distance, like a chess player deciding what moves to make. He is emotionally engaged. And we too are emotionally engaged. And the implications of this point are big. I mean, some people take pride in not being emotional. I'm rational, I'm not emotional. That's not something to take pride in. God is emotional. That's like taking pride in being a calculator. Just being cold and disengaged is dehumanizing. God is emotional. You look at Jesus. He rejoices. He loves. He's compassionate, but he also gets You see him experiencing anxiety, agonizing anxiety in the Garden of Gethsemane. He gets angry. He looks like he has a temper tantrum. And when he turns the tables over, he gets angry at the Pharisees. He is emotionally dynamic. He's a perfect representation of God. David, when you read the Psalms, the dude's masculine. And yet it looks like he's an emotional roller coaster. Right? I mean, there's some psalms that start off and he's extremely sad, and by the end of that psalm, he's praising God. And some of us in our pride would say, well, you're not stable. Well, yeah, but he is showing us what a healthy emotional life looks like. And I don't know, for some of us, it might be hard to picture God as emotional. Why do you think that is? Why is it hard to picture God as emotional? What's that? We often think that's a weakness. Good. Yeah. Were you going to say anything? We don't see him. He's also a judge. Yeah. Yeah. And I think if he's a judge, that makes it kind of scary to see a judge, a perfect judge, all powerful, who's also emotional. Because my experience, if I'm a judge, there's usually anger involved in my judging. And what does anger do to me? It pushes me around. It causes me, I feel like it makes me do things. Fear makes me behave. And I say makes in quotes. It doesn't technically make me, but it feels like it compels me to shy away from doing something I need to do, or anger forcefully moves me to do something. And Proverbs 16:32 says, whoever is slow to anger is better than the mighty, and he who controls a spirit is better than he who takes a city. Okay, so whoever is slow to anger is better than the mighty, and he takes that analogy a step further. If you can control your spirit, if you can control your anger, you're more mighty than a person who can overthrow a city, which is a really cool verse. But it's saying that, like, controlling your anger is hard, very hard to do. God, if he's angry, that's kind of a scary thought, right? This all-powerful being who's our judge is angry. I have an easier time picturing him as being robotic, cold, and distant, unmoved but doing the right thing always. But no, God is emotionally all in. And I would say a healthy emotional life, the volume in your emotion often goes up, not down. It doesn't get, you know what a compressor is in music? If you listen to music in the 70s, a lot of it's like really quiet and then really loud. They didn't have compressors then, but in the studio, they use compressors to make the really loud parts quieter and the quieter parts louder, and it all becomes a little more flat so you can hear the whole thing. And we think, well, maturity must be compressed emotions, that I'm not so up and down, but sometimes we should be up and down. That's not the problem with our emotions. We're going to look at where our emotions go unhealthy. But any questions up to this point? What was that? From what was the verse? Proverbs 16:32. Sometimes it might be 33, but I think it's 32. 32, yeah. You probably take a guess why I made that one of my memory verses. Okay, so a couple more things to understand about emotions. I'm just trying to lay a biblical foundation for this. Emotions are complex. This might be self-evident. They don't wait in single file line. What I mean is you don't experience typically one emotion at a time. You're not just simply angry. Maybe you're experiencing resentment mixed with some hurt, mixed with some disapproval, confusion, and sorrow. They all come together, you know. You're not just afraid, you're experiencing anxiety with some loneliness and a sense of unworthiness. So we're not dealing with one-dimensional emotions. You can be hopeful and nervous at the same time. Emotions are like those paint color machines at Home Depot. Have you guys ever gotten paint at the Yeah, where you go and you pick a color. I want dusty rose. They always have names like a tickled pink. And you go and you take that color and you give it to the guy, and he puts the code in and puts white paint underneath there, and then these colors come out, red, blue, and yellow, I think. They come out in certain proportions, and then they mix it and it makes dusty rose. Well, that's the way our emotions, I mean, they come. They show up in the complex. They don't wait in single file line. And it's is if the Bible doesn't deal with our emotions simplistically either. If you look at, like, say, Proverbs 31, for example, try to name the emotion that David is experiencing. It's not that simple. You look at Matthew 23 or John 11, in both of those passages, Jesus experiences this strange mixture of emotions through the whole section. John 11 is where Lazarus dies. Matthew 23, I think he's dealing with the Pharisees. But there's all sorts of things going on close up. The Bible doesn't treat our emotions simplistically. Neither, we don't need to do that either. Matthew 23, I just read it in my Bible reading thing. Jesus, he lays into the Pharisees because of their hypocrisy. He's really angry, and within a few verses, he's weeping over, he's lamenting Jerusalem for rejecting. So this anger and sadness show up, and he gives full voice to it. Next, and another, this is a profound idea that is going to follow us through the whole time. Emotions reveal what we love. Philippians 2, this is an interesting passage here. Paul says, I'm just read this passage. I've thought it necessary to send to you Epaphroditus, my brother and fellow worker and fellow soldier, and your messenger and minister to my need. For he has been longing for you. He's been longing for you all and has been distressed because you heard that he was ill. Indeed, he was ill, near to death, but God had mercy on him, and not only on him, but on me also, lest I should have sorrow upon sorrow. I am the more eager to send him, therefore, that you may rejoice at seeing him again, and that I may be less anxious. So receive him in the Lord with all joy. Okay, you don't need to necessarily know what's going on in this passage. I just want to highlight all of these emotion words show up in this little section, right? That's a lot of different emotions to be talking about. And the context, Paul is writing to the Philippians. He is worried about them because they heard that their boy Epaphroditus was ill, and they didn't even know if Epaphroditus was going to live. So Paul is sending Epaphroditus to them, but all these different feelings. I mean, Epaphroditus has been longing for them. He was distressed because they didn't know if he was even alive. Paul confesses being anxious for them. All these different emotions. What ties those emotions together? What's the thing that's common to all of them? Love. Every one of those emotions are an outworking of a love, relationship, whether it's between Epaphroditus and the Philippians, or Paul and Epaphroditus, or Paul and the Philippians. They love each other. There's lots of strong emotions going on. They're all good. He's talking to people he knows. He loves and treasures them. He wants their well-being. And, you know, that's why that passage, 1 Corinthians 12, 26, if one member of the church suffers, we all suffer. We're supposed to love one another, and we care about what's going on with other people. So emotions are the physical sensations in response to thoughts and beliefs about particular events and relationships. That's the definition at the beginning. Unlike moods, they are an overflow of a particular love. Let's see here. Yeah, you could see a pattern of emotions. The way I like to think of them is they're like the check engine light on the dashboard. That thing comes on, and you're not dealing with the dashboard. You're supposed to be then dealing with what's under the hood. When we're trying to deal with our emotions and just mute the emotion itself without dealing with what it's tied to, it's purpose. It's pointless. It's fruitless. I heard the phrase, pleasure is the measure of your treasure. Right? Whatever makes you happy, is tied to something that you actually treasure. Fair enough. I think that's a, if I only had that, I would be happy. If you make me late, you're going to feel my wrath. Well, what's loved? If I get angry because you're making me late, what do I love? I love being on time. I don't know if that's what you said. But I love maybe I love the perception of being on time. People see me a certain way, or maybe I like the feeling of being in control, or maybe I like the feeling of having security at my job, whatever it might be. There's a love that's tied to that, and my anger is not necessarily the first thing I want to look at. If I lose this blank, I can't get out of bed. Whatever. When my son is disrespectful, one of my sons is particularly willful, okay, and I get really upset with him. When he's that way, am I getting upset because there's a fool inside my child that's going to destroy him, or because he's making me look inadequate as a parent? No, it's because there's a fool in my son. I never struggle with sinful anger toward my son. I typically get angry for the wrong reason. The anger is a good response if it's for the right reason, right? But the love at the heart of it is the issue that we always need to be looking at. What is the emotion revealing about what I actually love? So emotions are like a worship audit. I'm stealing these phrases from other people, but it reveals what we worship. So I think this is a true story. I know it happened, but I might be exaggerating it a bit. We have three kids, Charlie, Lincoln, and Lucy. And at the time, I believe Lucy was probably 2, Charlie was 3, that would have made Lincoln about 7 or 8. And I was giving Brandy a badly needed break, and I was just taking the kids with me on some errands. And I remember I went by Frost Bank to make a deposit. And when I pulled up to the little drive-thru, immediately, I think Lincoln put it together. What do you think Lincoln asked for? Lollipop. Lollipop. So the moment Lincoln said lollipop, Charlie and Lucy were like, lollipop, lollipop. And everybody was so excited about a lollipop. And I was experiencing this excitement on adrenaline mixed with some like nervous, like, oh, are we going to get a lollipop? Dad, can we have a lollipop? I was like, yeah. Well, are you going to ask him for a lollipop? I'm like, yeah, I will. Don't worry, guys. So I'm just trying to contain their excitement, their joy and their fear, all these emotions coming up. And when that little machine thing, I put my deposit slip in and it went in, and there wasn't an immediate response. So that excitement turned to fear. Like, why aren't they responding? What's taking them so long? Right? So that anticipation kind of turned into an irritated anticipation. And I kind of made that little hint, yeah, well, our three kids back here, are excited to be here. Like, oh, okay, they get spoken code. Yeah, I get it. And they put the lollipops in that little space-age tube, and it comes back. I open it up, and they gave me plenty of lollipops. And so when they saw that lollipops came, it was like eureka, like the lottery had just been won. And they were so excited, but that excitement quickly was overshadowed by the competition of, I want the purple one, I want that flavor. And so now they're clamoring over each other for that certain flavor, and there was plenty of them. I gave it to them, ecstatic joy, worship. It was just beauty. And everything, as they're eating their lollipop, Charlie leans over and I think knocks the lollipop out of Lucy's mouth. That lollipop fell on the floor, and they went from the extreme highs to extreme low, the bottom of bottoms. Lucy is wailing, murderous just desire in there. Charlie dared to knock that out, and I'm just, there's crying now. And this is all in a short period of time, right? I pick up the lollipop, lick off the lint, and I give it back to Lucy. And now there's like this disgust, you know, like, and kind of like a satisfied, confused, like a emotional hangover. And all of this because they worshiped the lollipop, all right? It was that you could see unfiltered worship over something as silly as a lollipop. All right. We do the same thing, right? When you get older, our emotions are not so wildly tied to little things like that. But it doesn't We haven't come that far, right? I mean, your computer freezes and you get really angry, or traffic is a weak spot for a lot of us, right? I mean, you get caught behind a certain type of driver and it's just, what do you worship? You left at just the right time. I talked about our kids losing it over a lollipop. And yeah, this is a while back. They would never. We just did a road trip yesterday and came back, and toward the end of it too, it was just every emotion in the book. Like the last hour of a 6-hour road trip is hell with kids. I'm so impressed that you're here. Yeah. Well, anyway, I'm probably digressing. We see this in ourselves, right? That there's something we love, there's something we have to have or worshiping behind a lot of our emotions. And not every single emotion, but the really strong ones are tied to things that we love, that we're worshiping. So I have an example, it's a little more serious. I came across this. This isn't like autobiographical or anything. A husband was struggling with his anger. And his wife, they had kids, his wife was going to be gone on a church retreat for 24 hours, so not very long. And she says to her husband, "Honey, the only thing I ask of you while I'm gone is that you don't yell at the kids while I'm gone." Okay? So it kind of gives you a hint as to the condition of things. Obviously, the husband's struggling with anger, and her bar is being set pretty low in this example. She goes on the church retreat. She comes back to find that there had been a lot of anger, a lot of yelling, and she's mystified, discouraged. He's mystified because he intended to not yell. He didn't want to fail on that one simple request, but he did, and he yelled at the kids, and when she came back, everybody was bewildered. So this is what sent them to counseling. What happened? Well, the husband, when he received that request, kind of realized, I'm not very high on my wife's estimation. Like, all she's asking me is that I don't yell at the kids. I'm on thin ice here. And so what does he do while they're gone? I'm going to take care of the kids, but she's not going to just come home to like, oh, we didn't yell. I'm going to fix the clock on the stove. All right? She's going to come home and go, honey, you fixed the clock. You're wonderful, you know? Okay, so he goes to start to fix the clock on the stove, and guess what happens? He proceeds to break not only the clock, but break the stove as well. Now the stove isn't working, and he's frustrated and trying to figure this out, and while he's doing this and trying to get it fixed before mom comes back, one of the kids comes in and says, Daddy, can I have this, or maybe tells, and in the process of him being frustrated about the stove, he yells at the kids, and there are tears and everything else. And then his wife comes home. Everybody's mystified. What was he loving? What? Himself, okay. More specifically, I agree with that. His wife's approval. That was what he needed, right? That's what drove him to fix the clock on the stove. He wanted to go up in his wife's estimation. And what happened when he started to fix the clock? It got worse. And now the thing he was trying to work for is being blocked by the stove and now by these kids, because now they're asking for something and I can't now devote my attention to the stove. And everything was spiraling out of control because what he loved, his wife's approval and admiration and respect, was slipping from his grasp. Anger is not happening in a vacuum. There are things going on that we love that are under the surface that we don't always immediately see. So I wrote down some examples. If I care deeply if people like me, I'll be deeply hurt if I'm left out. If I don't want to look like an idiot, maybe I'm going to get nervous before that Bible study that I'm leading. If I care about pleasing God and living for Him, I'm going to be really encouraged when I see more patience and more growth in my walk. If I care about my child's well-being, I'll be anxious about how she's doing on her first day of school. Just some examples. So with everything that I've said so far, there are two really key points. I think a lot of this might be review for us, but there are two key points that I want to highlight, and it's that emotions connect us relationally, and emotions reveal what we love. I mean, it's all kind of important, but those two ideas are going to be key as we continue to move forward. So what goes wrong with our emotions? What's the problem with them? The problem, first of all, is that emotions have been corrupted. Our emotions have been corrupted by sin. We see Jesus fully emotional, but he was like the master emotional sailor. He was never compelled against his will by his emotions. His emotions moved him, but it was never contrary to the will of God. But for us, our emotions have been corrupted. Not just our emotions, they've been corrupted because our thinking has been corrupted by sin. Our feeling, our desires, our wills, and certainly our emotions as well. Everything has been touched and corrupted by sin. And as a result of that, just some examples of the way sin corrupts our emotions. As a result of this, emotions boss us around. They don't serve us all the time. They seem to work against us. There's a reason for that, actually. First of all, the way our brains work, if you touch a hot stove, the signal from that heat goes through your arm, hits your brain stem, and immediately goes back. And you have a reflex. You don't think, oh, this is hot. Move it. You know, you do something and you immediately respond. And that's God's way of saying, like, there are times where you don't need to think, is this hot? Maybe I ought to move my hand. So the least amount of damage is done. If you try to remember what the capital of New Mexico is, to answer that, you are using your prefrontal cortex. You're thinking rationally right up there. What's in between, though, is the limbic system, or the amygdala, and it is where you process your emotions. You feel from your amygdala. And you don't necessarily, when you feel something, you don't necessarily have to think rationally about it. So the signal doesn't have to travel as far to get to the emotional aspect. And the amygdala is the size of an almond, and it cannot add 2 + 2. It cannot think rationally. It can only feel and respond. So you feel certain ways without having to think about it. It makes sense. So when you see something you're really afraid of, a snake, you jump back. Doesn't matter that there's 2 inches of glass and you're at the zoo between you, right? Or you feel a certain way, like you might have a certain emotional reaction to flying, and you know it's safe. But if you're afraid, I mean, nobody has to tell you how to feel. When someone has gut-busting laughter, they can't stop laughing, they're having what's called an emotional hijacking. I mean, or when your anger takes over, you're not you become emotionally drunk. That's emotional hijacking, emotional drunkenness, it's all the same thing. I feel myself getting emotionally drunk when I'm angry. Like, I feel myself getting stupider. It's really frustrating, you know? If I'm in an argument, I can feel myself, it's weird. One part of me feels like I'm getting smarter, but when I'm getting a little more in my right mind, I realize I'm getting dumber. And then when I look back and I said, I actually thought that when I said it. One time I told Brandy, you always have to be right. Not one time, I've said it a few times. But I said, you always have to be right. And it's like, that is the classic pot calling the kettle black thing. I'm the one who always has to be right. Don't hold that against me. You know, next time, no. You don't hold that against me. I know that. But I think in that moment that was true. And I think I'm being all clear-headed. And I look back and I'm like, that was silly. That was a stupid thing to say. It was untrue, but it felt so true at the time. And then when I start to kind of like sober up emotionally, I feel frustrated because I can't remember. Sometimes in the middle of an argument, I can't remember what's going on. Anybody else feel the same way? And so an emotional hijacking is when signals are not making their way all the way there. Well, all the way to the rational thinking. And this is important because emotions, they boss us around. They come and they sabotage. For example, anger has a good purpose, but when we just respond, we usually end up hurting, instead of the problem, we end up hurting the person, right? I've heard someone say, anger is supposed to be like a scalpel, and like a surgeon, we go and we cut out the problem. We cut out the cancer, the sin, and instead we take a sword and we slash the person. Anger out of control is damaging. Anger in control is very powerful. That's why God calls us to be slow to anger. Whoever is slow to anger is better than the mighty. I don't trust my anger. I slow down and I have to get sober and think about what's the problem? What's the right way to respond? When I start to do that, I'm moving into my prefrontal cortex, and it's not like I just throw out the anger altogether. I have to think, what's the right way to respond with this? And so emotions boss us around. Proverbs 12:18 says, reckless words pierce like a sword, but the words of the wise bring healing. Meaning, when you speak thoughtlessly, it's like you're stabbing someone. What you just said, you can't just take it back and it's gone. The anger did the damage, and now the wound is still there, even if you try to take it back. It's really powerful. Another emotion that will boss me around, I need to have a tough conversation with somebody, but I don't want to. I don't want to know how that's going to go. So my fear will say, don't have it. Just do the easier thing. You can name any emotion. You're attracted to someone you shouldn't be attracted to. You go and you talk to them even though you shouldn't. Pick any emotion. Another result is emotions alienate and isolate us. They're supposed to connect us relationally, but more often than not, strong emotions have the opposite effect, right? When you're angry, how well do you connect to somebody, especially if they're involved? You know, that's why the people closest to us often bring out the worst in us, is because they're tied to the emotions that we're feeling. We're supposed to heal by connecting to them, but instead, we either attack or we isolate. And then when someone opens up and really pours out and opens up with their strong emotions, we might fix them and say, well, you shouldn't feel that way, or you should do this instead, or we try to rescue them and say, hey, it's no big deal, or it's okay, it's gonna be fine. Saying, you know, hey, it's gonna be okay after a tough day, that could be said in a comforting way, but it's okay, it's no big deal. Does that help? Usually that doesn't go so well. It can, if it's said lovingly, if it's said with emotion, but sometimes it's like, let's get past this uncomfortable feeling and let me just cover over it and move on. And when that's the motivation behind it, it doesn't go well. I make the mistake of taking hurt, and I mean, I know you've experienced this on too many occasions, where Brandy's sharing about something she's burdened by or hurt by, and I hear a shred of an attack in it. She's not attacking me, but I take it as an attack because I am somewhat potentially involved. And so instead of just hurting with her, I'm like, well, I didn't do anything or whatever, and I go defensive. Now who am I caring about? Me. And keep in mind, I'm teaching this stuff and I still get it wrong. It's not like, oh, just knowing this is the solution, but it's understanding and kind of moving toward the fact that the opportunity is to connect, but we miss that either when this emotion's too powerful for me to bring to somebody else and to connect with, or that emotion coming at me is too powerful to engage. And that's the opportunity that we miss, because emotions tend to isolate and alienate us, which is a result of sin corrupting our emotions. And let's see. Ultimately, emotions dehumanize us. For example, when my anger gets the better of me, or my fear gets the better of me or whatever, you become the angry guy. You just become the fearful person. You're not, that's a dehumanizing effect. But the other side of it is you hit mute on your emotions. You suppress them and you don't feel them because they're too dangerous. And what ends up happening is by suppressing your emotions, you start to feel indifferent. Apathy is the most dehumanizing toxic emotion, indifference. Eli Wiesel was a concentration camp survivor who spoke a lot on indifference. That there, when those soldiers came in to rescue concentration camp victims, they were horrified, disgust, okay? And that was an appropriate response to what they walked into. But the people who were kind of like, well, you know, if you mute emotions on that, if you don't feel anger when you come across that kind of atrocity, that is dehumanizing, is it not? So to not be angry at certain things is a problem. So the implication is anger itself is not the problem. Sometimes we need to be angry. Ultimately, what we love has been corrupted by sin. That's at the root of it all. If Brandy were to call me in the middle of work and say, honey, I got in a car wreck, and I say, how's the car? What's wrong with the car? What's wrong with that? Yeah. Wrong question, right? Are you okay? I should care more about my wife than about my car. Is it okay to care about my car? Sure. But there is a proper order of loves, right? So in Matthew 22, when Jesus says, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind, and love your neighbor as yourself, you kind of see a priority. We should love God with all of our heart. When you see Jesus getting really angry, what is he getting angry about? The glory of God is being trampled on in the temple. Or the Pharisees are making it hard for other people to know God by all their rules. He loved properly. He wasn't upset about his inconvenience. He wasn't upset about being, you know, thrown under the bus or whatever. That's not the thing that made him mad. He loved in the proper order. Our loves have been corrupted by sin. That's at the root of all of this. So what's the difference between a healthy and an unhealthy emotion? The answer is twofold. It depends on what the emotion is coming from and where it is moving me. Those are the two places emotions go bad. It's how is it making me respond? That's usually the secondary thing. The first thing is, what's my emotion coming from? So I to graphically put it up here, thinking back on the definition we had at the beginning, emotions are responses to thoughts and beliefs that are tied to circumstances and relationships. So this is what the emotion is coming from, and this is the response that we see. So here's an example. Is happiness a toxic emotion? It is if you've been flirting with someone else's spouse. And you're excited, you're happy. Hey, I've been flirting with someone else's spouse, this is great. And the thinking is, well, if nobody finds out, it's not a problem. That is a toxic emotion, right? And so the response to that is I'm going to cover my tracks and flirt some more. So happiness is a toxic emotion in this case, right? What about jealousy? Is jealousy a toxic emotion? Not necessarily. Not if my spouse is flirting with someone else. You should be jealous, right? What is jealousy? It's a protection over what is mine. God is a jealous God. He gets jealous when we are falling in love with other things over him, right? So my spouse is flirting with someone else, he's supposed to be flirting with me. Okay, that's a healthy response. But if that jealousy leads you to go set someone else's house on fire, that is an unhealthy response, right? Outworking of that. So we're not dealing with like just the emotion. There's two sides to the emotion that we need to kind of look at. What is it coming from and how is it moving me? And we can get it wrong on both ends. Two emotional pitfalls, I'm about to let you go here, but how are you not supposed to handle emotions? Well, two unhealthy tendencies. One, don't suppress your emotion. I'll put them both up here. Don't suppress your emotions and don't embrace your emotions either. What I mean by suppressing your emotions, muting them, using things like busyness, distractions, escapism. It could be drinking your sorrows away, but it could also, I do mindless things, games or social media, those kinds of things, or just very often just being busy. I don't stop and feel what I'm experiencing if they're unpleasant feelings. And so those are one unhealthy way. And numbing your emotions, it can over time lead to an inability to feel. I counseled somebody a while back, a couple years ago. His presenting issue was he was emotional. It was a form of depression in which he was emotionally numb. He could not feel. He didn't feel anything, up or down. It was just, he was emotionally flat. And it was really hard because that was his way of coping with life, was just not feeling. I remember not too long ago, I was consciously learning these things and just, I need to feel more what I feel. I kind of was learning this. And around this time, I think I found out some news at work that kind of had me worried. Some friends of ours tragically lost one of their children. And there was some other things going on, just some family stresses. And all those things together, I was just allowing myself to feel it, okay? It didn't hit me like a ton of bricks. It just was like just kind of a steady trickle. And I remember one time I was mowing the lawn. Do you remember this? Okay, I was mowing the lawn and I just suddenly got hit with this overwhelming sadness. And I turned off the lawnmower and I just started to like pray and kind of cry out to God, but thank him at the same time because it was sweet. It was a good feeling because I could tell how healthy it was because I normally don't spend time and actually just let these feelings land on me. Instead, I kind of push them away through busyness and being productive or being unproductive. But instead of just simply feeling it. So that's one thing. So, and all of us have a tendency to do one or the other, or maybe even both, depending on the emotion. The other side of it, though, is engaging your blindly embracing your emotions, is trusting them as authoritative. If I'm angry, I've got good reason to be angry. I'm going to trust it and run with it. Or if I'm sad or if I'm afraid, if I wrote down some examples here. Actually, I thought I did. I'm reading a book where he actually calls it feelism, that you rely on your feelings as the measure of your reality. I am what I feel. So I'm not going to say something to you if it's true because I don't feel it, because that would be disingenuous. You know, if I don't feel in love with God at the moment, I can't say I love you, God. Or I don't feel God's love for me. Well, does he love me? I don't feel it. Well, are we supposed to stand on our feelings as authoritative? Or do we stand on an objective truth? Do the feelings come as a result later? So it's knowing, like, where do you tend to go? Do you tend to suppress your emotions or embrace them? We're not supposed to do either one of those things. We're actually called to, biblically, we're called to engage our emotions. God doesn't call us to avoid or squash our emotions. He doesn't call us to embrace them unconditionally. He calls us to engage them. That's where we're going next week. But before we can engage our emotions, we need to learn from them. And so that's where this READ analogy or READ acronym comes from. If you've ever taken relational wisdom, I cover this in that class. But this is a helpful way to break it down when you're experiencing emotions. Let me put all of them up here, and I'll just talk about it from there. When we're experiencing a strong emotion, we need to recognize what we're feeling, evaluate why we're feeling it, anticipate where it's leading us, and try to direct ourselves on a different path. Before I talk about this, I will say this. I don't expect anybody to apply this right away in the midst of strong emotions. I was teaching this for a while before I actually learned how to apply it. And the way I learned it was if we got into an argument, the next day I remembered, oh, I was supposed to read myself, right? And I would think back on what happened yesterday and ask myself, what was I feeling? I was feeling accused or whatever. Why was I feeling that? So this is a made-up example. I'm washing Charlie and my middle child, and I send him out of the shower. He's all dried off, and Randy says, "Hey, you didn't rinse all the hair out of shampoo out of Charlie's hair. Or, why didn't you rinse the shampoo out of Charlie's hair?" "Oh, what? What do you mean I didn't rinse the shampoo out of his hair? I totally rinsed it, you know." And I get all defensive. Okay, what was I feeling? I was feeling accused, right? Why was I feeling that? Is it because I really cared about Charlie's hair and how much whether the shampoo was out of it? No, I felt like my competence as a dad was being questioned at that moment. That's why I got defensive. So how does my defensiveness, how does it play out? Can I anticipate where my defensiveness normally leads me? It leads me to acting more childish, and it usually makes things kind of spiral downwards, right? I've helped to remember that in the moment, right? But what could I have done? Thinking back to what happened yesterday, what could I have done differently? I could have stopped and been slow to respond and just, I didn't know he still had shampoo in his hair. I can rinse it out more or whatever. Responds differently. But what would happen to me is I taught it a few times. I didn't come up with this. I taught it a few times, and then when I would see, like, I'm not applying this, so I would learn to start applying it a day or two later, and I started to see patterns in my heart, patterns in my responses, patterns in my emotions. And so if we had a common argument around me being, that led to me being defensive, I could see usually I get defensive around these situations, and it wouldn't take me as long to figure out my emotional patterns. So something might happen, and maybe I wouldn't respond right away, but soon after I could learn from my emotions. And it started to happen faster and faster. And eventually there were times where something would happen and normally we would argue right then, and I would learn to read myself right then and say, what am I feeling right now? The moment I ask myself in the middle of a strong emotion, what am I feeling? Major victory right there. Just doing R is a major victory in the middle of a strong emotion. Why?
You don't
react to it. Okay, can the amygdala answer the question, what am I feeling? No. And in my emotional drunkenness, I can't stop and I can't stay in my emotional reactivity. It's being interrupted by the question. Even calling to mind, there's an acronym I'm supposed to do right now. When my emotions are taking me, are on me, and there's a tailspin, to stop and ask that question is to say, there is something else I need to be thinking right now. And asking, what am I feeling, is a cognitive prefrontal cortex question. Answering the question is not always simple. Asking why am I feeling this way is more difficult, but over time you can see there's typical reasons I respond certain ways. And then anticipate, where does this lead me and how can I direct myself in a different course? We're going to get into that, but my hope in sharing this is that this week, try this. Try to read yourself. Try to learn from your emotions between now and next week. And then next week we're going to talk about how do you then engage properly in the areas of with your emotions. What I like about this is it doesn't matter what emotion you're experiencing, you can do this. I would suggest try it with emotions that aren't so toxic. Okay, why am I irritated? I'm just minorly irritated right now. Why? What am I feeling? I'm minorly irritated. By the way, this chart is meant to kind of give you, for those of us who are not eloquent, the emotions that are near the top are the more intense emotions. Certainly the ones across the very top are the generalized emotion, but then there's a scale of very intense to less intense. So you can go and find your emotion and name it if you need help, but then if you go and try this a few times, even if it's the day after an emotional issue, you're gonna start to see patterns, and it's going to make where we're going a lot more fruitful. What's that? Oh, cool, well, thank you. Any questions? It is hot in here, isn't it? So my emotionally fiery teaching. Okay, well, let me pray, and then I will dismiss. Father, thank you so much for our time together. And I pray, Lord, that you would teach us not just what your word says about emotions, but what our emotions say about us, what our emotions reveal about what it is that we love and worship. And certainly we see probably the way our emotions lead us to respond. I pray that we can understand that there's a process you're taking us on, and not to be too quick to condemn ourselves where we are emotionally a wreck or we're emotionally damaging things. Help us to just learn this week what we need to learn, what you want to teach us about ourselves, and make the rest of our time together extremely profitable. We love you. We pray to you in Jesus' name. Amen.